Welcome back to another episode of The Adam Paradox. Today we are continuing our discussion on beliefs and the good, the bad, the ugly of religion and why it's maybe good to let go of it or why it's good to keep it. We'll figure that out as we go on. But I wanted to bring up an article that was sent to me recently and just kind of discuss why a belief can be bad in some cases. And although we are entitled to our beliefs and have the freedom to have them, to practice them or whatever, like, and express them. We have that freedom in America. I mean, especially in America and in many other countries, we all have the right to say these things regardless of what the consequences are. It just doesn't mean it's necessarily good for our health or good for our lifestyle. So this article comes from WIBW.com, from Fox 19, Nick Viovanni by Jessica Schmidt. This is from Cincinnati, Ohio. The parents of a toddler who was fighting stage 4 cancer are shocked after they said they received a hateful message from a stranger. Callie Schaefer, who is a little more than 1 year old, was diagnosed with neuroblastoma in January. She has since spent more than 100 days at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. Her family members said she has faced chemotherapy treatments, viruses, and this week a major operation. Surgeons, her relative said, removed about 90% of a cancerous tumor that was inside her abdomen. Through everything, she has always kept the biggest smile. She's tiny but mighty for a reason, said Trisha Lamb, Kelly's aunt. Just watching her strength is inspiring. The silly, sweet little girl inspires the parents, Tiffany and Aubrey Schaefer, Candace Beale, to never give up hope. From the start, they said the support has been overwhelming and has helped them get through each and every day. Kelly's parents said they were stunned when they received what they called a hate-filled, horrible message from someone they do not know. I was disgusted. I was shocked, said Aubrey. That's mainly what it was. Shock and hurt at the same time. And in the message, the person wrote, "My prayers for Callie. I was going to donate $7,600 to her fund, but I found out her parents are lesbians. I've chosen to donate to St. Jude due to that fact. Sorry, I'll still pray for her, though. But maybe it's God's way of getting your attention that she needs a mommy and a daddy, not two mommies." Now, the issue with this is it's saying that basically I have translated or interpreted what God has said. And through me, I am giving you a lesson on being a lesbian. And maybe you shouldn't be, or otherwise I would have given you $7,600. There's no proof of this $7,600. It could have just been, you know, 76 cents for all we know, but or nothing. It just using God in this manner is not God. If there was one, because nobody on his behalf can speak for him on his behalf, nor would I think they would, because we don't do that for people very often, unless we're lying or sociopathic, for instance. So why would somebody go and do this to someone else when who cares if they're a lesbian? I mean, that's my objection. Who cares? If you don't agree with anything, that's fine. We're not asking you to. We're not asking for that. We just ask for prayers and support for Callie, said Lamb. She's loved. She's being taken care of. Why does it matter? Why would you want to hurt someone who is already hurting? Though Callie's family said the message was heartbreaking to read, they said it is not about them. It is about Callie. They actually thanked whoever sent the message, saying it has brought more awareness to her journey. Callie's parents said the person's words will not change how much they love their daughter or how hard they are going to fight beside her. There are several fundraisers in place to help the family, including a GoFundMe page and a t-shirt sale. The Black and Bluegrass Roller Girls are raising money for Callie and her family during the team's home opener on April 13th. Details can be found here. There will be a link in the website that goes to this article. Anyone wishing to help can also donate meal cards to Schaefer's And you can call 513-636-5009 and press number 9. Each meal card is $6. And Callie's parents said use the name Callie Reynolds because the hospital has not changed her last name since she was adopted. The family is asking anyone who donates a food card to message the Callie Strong Facebook page to let them know. Now, I think this is kind of an incredible thing, and it's very sad that she's going through cancer. And for someone to say that, I think it's just trolling. Is somebody that is likely hurting themselves, and typically when you are hurting, you project and you find other sources, and then you also try to put this whole thing of beliefs and the common person that likes to find belief or find religion or find things to believe in that other people will accept, no matter how absurd, are the narcissistic, sociopathic, and psychopathic people with those behavioral tendencies. In this case, I think what we have is just a common troll, somebody who felt they could use this and that as a way to justify their means. And I also had an issue with a recent post that kind of correlates with this, that a lot of religious people feel that they are in some sort of battle. That you shouldn't go to the battlefield unprepared. And if this is what the battle is fighting the lesbians or fighting the gays or fighting social injustice based on personal belief or what you think is God's perfect plan or will, but no one knows exactly what that is or what it entails or what the details are and what the policies are, then I think there is a lot wrong with it. And that's not a battle. That's just being a bully. So moving on to the next segment. I found an old video of Kirk Cameron and Ray Comfort's old debates against atheists, and I thought it'd be interesting to go through it and pick through some of the things they said and just kind of talk about it and see what there really is and what there really isn't, and just sort of discuss what I think about it.
Hi, I'm Kirk Cameron, and my partner Ray Comfort and I come to you tonight not as molecular biologists or as rocket scientists, but simply as an author and an actor, and we want to do two things that fly in the face of convention. One, we'd like to show you that the existence of God can be proven 100% absolutely without the use of faith. And secondly, as a former atheist myself, an evolutionist, I want to pull back the curtain and show that the number one reason many people do not believe in God is not because of a lack of evidence, but because of a theory that many scientists today consider to be a fairy tale for grown-ups.
So are we right in assuming, Mr. Cameron, that scientists are the enemy? That they don't have the best interest of reality or what's real or what's testable to be real? It's interesting you call yourself an evolutionist as if it was a bad thing when Darwin was a Christian himself.
I by no means am looking for trouble or looking to encourage persecution. I'm motivated purely by a concern for what's going to happen to people if they die without Christ. It's simply, in a word, compassion.
But there are many verses in the Bible that talk about persecution. For instance, 2 Timothy 3:12, indeed all who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. If the world hates you, know that it has hated me before it hated you, John 15:18. Matthew 5:10, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Seems to me that there's a lot in the Bible that talks about being persecuted, and there's over 100 different references that... I mean, it's kind of like, hey, the more you're persecuted, the more righteous you are, or the better and more blessed you'll be by God because you're doing his work. If a creator created something, why would he do so with the intent or allowance of being hated?
Most people believe the existence of God can't be proven. It's all a matter of faith, but I disagree. I believe God's existence can be proven absolutely, scientifically, without even mentioning faith. And before we do so, let's define the word scientific. It comes from a Latin word, scientificus, which means producing knowledge.
Already we've heard an incorrect assessment or definition of the word. And when you hear this, especially if you're in person and don't have all these resources available, it's going to be very believable because, oh my gosh, this guy sounds smart and he's done his homework. Not only that, he's very enthusiastic about what he talks about. However, the actual definition of science is the intellectual and practical activity encompassing the systematic study of the structure and behavior of the physical and natural world through observation and experiment. One of my typical arguments when anyone says, well, God is real, he just hasn't shown himself to you. That's up to him to show himself to you. If you can't observe, if you can't demonstrate a God, it likely does not exist. I can't observe gravity. However, I can observe its effects. I can demonstrate that gravity or that there is a pull to the earth does exist by dropping a pen, very simply. I can't even get close enough to do that for God. And his other one, a scientificus, even when you get down to scientific as a definition or an adjective, based on or characterized by the methods and principles of science, still does not mean what he said it did. It's not producing knowledge. That is maybe a byproduct of what happens when you observe and discover things. You are now knowing certain things, but that doesn't mean that you have now gained knowledge. It may mean you have just identified or defined something more specifically. And when we get to scientificus, the definition of scientific is something relating to science, natural science, or done very systematically. An example of scientific study is the study of astronomy. An example of scientific method is using exact measurements for a building project.
To prove God's existence, we could look at subjects such as entropy, cosmology, biochemistry, relativity, or quantum mechanics. While they're fascinating subjects, what we want to do tonight is confine ourselves to what the Greeks called beautiful simplicity. We'll be simply producing knowledge by looking at three irrefutable evidences for God's existence. And I'd like to begin by looking at creation. I'd like to share with you a theory I have of where the Coca-Cola can may have come from. Billions of years ago, there was a massive explosion in space. No one knows what caused the explosion. It just kind of happened. It was a big bang, and from this big bang issued a huge rock. And on top of the rock was found this brown, sweet, bubbly substance. And over millions of years, aluminum crept up the side, formed itself into a lid, and then a tab. And then millions of years later, red paint and white paint fell from the sky and formed itself in the words Coca-Cola Classic, 12 fluid ounces, original formula. You say, what are you doing? You're insulting my intellect. And so I am. You know, if the Coca-Cola can was made, there must be a maker. If it's designed, there must be a designer. To believe this happened by sheer chance is to move into an intellectual free zone.
Now, I haven't heard this full video, but here's one thing, Ray, that you are kind of saying that's a bit incorrect. There is a difference between intervention and non-intervention. In other words, natural occurrence or non-naturally occurring. There are things that will grow and happen and develop whether or not someone directly or indirectly interferes with it. And that is what you're describing. A Coca-Cola can cannot create itself. You're right. It does need a creator, much like a painting needs a painter. However, none of those things will happen unless human intervention has happened to it or some other interventional force. However, a naturally occurring one such as a tree, a river, mountains, were all done naturally without any human intervention or God intervention. It happened naturally, much like the universe did. So your argument is there moot.
Listen to what two of the greatest scientific minds in history said about the design and creation. Sir Isaac Newton: the most beautiful system of the sun, the planets, and comets could only proceed from the counsel and dominion of an intelligent and powerful being.
Sir Isaac Newton was around back in 1700s. He did believe in God and everything, but he didn't believe in the Trinity. And most philosophers back then also believed in God. They didn't have the tools and methods to test, to cancel out or rule out if anything had been God or naturally caused or supernaturally caused. And a lot of natural weather and events were seen to be acts of God only because we didn't have the tools then to determine that that was just a weather phenomena. So I don't think using a reference of a philosopher or somebody from way back when, you know, 300-400 years ago, is a very reliable method for determining, hey, this is how I can prove there's a God, because even these guys believed it. It doesn't matter who believes it. You could have the smartest person in the world believing the dumbest mundane thing, and it still doesn't prove or make sense of anything that you're trying to claim.
Albert Einstein, he said, in the view of such harmony in the cosmos, which I, with my limited human mind, am able to recognize, there are yet people who say there's no God. And then he added this statement, but what makes me really angry is that they quote me to support such views.
And once again, Albert Einstein is a theoretical physicist. That does not make him an expert on whether or not God's real. Now, he did come up with E equals MC squared, and he's got some very like marvelous achievements. What Albert Einstein doesn't say, and a lot of Christians like to use him as a reference, what he doesn't say is that he believes in God. He believes that there is a possibility of a God, that you can't rule that out. And I get that. He also believes in a pantheistic God, a God that no matter how much we keep reducing everything, is likely only the starter of the Big Bang, the initial cause, and that's it. That throughout all the other events, he's been absent or lazy. So he is not one of the Christian God. He's not one saying that there is a creator. He's saying we haven't done anything yet to rule out the possibility that if one is claimed that he did or did not do something. In other words, we can't jump to the conclusion. So far, all we can do right now is theorize or imagine. But we haven't been able to get to the point where we can go, this is what God did and this is what he didn't do. This is how he operated and this is how he doesn't operate. We can't even get to that point yet. All we can do is say, if there was a beginning to the universe, you hit the spot and, you know, that was the Big Bang. And that was all God's did in that point. But then you got Stephen Hawking, who comes up with a different relative theory and how it goes back on itself, how the universe goes back on itself to a point of origin, and then boom, you get a bang again. And that's where we get quantum theory, that this could be like the 13th version of the universe. We don't know. It's possible that it goes much bigger and much farther than we could possibly imagine. And it's kind of like infinity, but that just means that it's always existed. But we want to comprehend something because it gets simplified to a point of if it had to start somewhere. Well, it's possible, but maybe not. Maybe it's too big for us to even know or ever know. And the whole point of being here is just to enjoy our life.
It really is very simple. Let me show you what I mean. When I look at this building, how do I know there was a builder? You can't see him, hear him, touch him, taste him, or smell him. I mean, what evidence is there was a builder? Well, the building is absolute 100% scientific proof there was a builder. You can't have a building without a builder. I don't need faith to believe in a builder. All I need is eyes that can see and a brain that works.
So then where's the building of God? How do we know that God exists, or that he did have a hand in anything, if we can't find his blueprints, if we can't find his handprint, finger marks, anything that suggests that God had a hand in anything? By far one of the dumbest arguments from ignorance I have heard in not really a long time. I hear it kind of often, actually.
You say that's not scientific, because for something to be scientific, it must be able to be verified through repeatable testing in controlled conditions in laboratory.
Wrong. It doesn't have to be in a lab. It just has to be repeatable, demonstrable, observable, measurable, and testable.
Well, this same principle works with paintings and painters. When I look at a painting, how can I know there was a painter? Well, the painting is absolute 100% scientific proof there was a painter. You can't have a painting without a painter. I don't need faith to believe in a painter. All I need is eyes that can see and a brain that works.
You know it's a painting if there's a painter, because you can't naturally develop a painting without any human intervention or other foresoul intervention of some kind. You can, however, have that with trees and other naturally occurring things in this planet. Whether or not if I like it, the damn dandelions keep growing. Do I think someone put them there or created them to be there just to make my life hell?
And as I said, you might say, well, that's not scientific. What you need is a controlled laboratory testing. It needs to be observed. Okay, we could put a dozen scientists in a laboratory and tell them to observe this painting. And I'm sure after a while they would come to the conclusion that there was a painter that painted the painting. We could repeat the experiment again and again, and they'd obviously come to the same conclusion. Why? Because the painting is absolute observable proof there was a painter. And exactly the same applies with the existence of God.
Okay, so let's put something in a room and see if a god creates anything. I think we can come to the conclusion a god doesn't create anything. I mean,
How do we know God exists? You can't see him, hear him, touch him, taste him, or smell him. Well, creation is 100% scientific proof there was a creator.
That is a lie and a false statement. Nowhere in any science or any history has anyone ever said the earth is proof that there was a God. Ever. 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 No one ever has ever said that.
You cannot have a creation without a creator.
You're right. You cannot have a creation without a creator, but you're jumping to the conclusion that earth is a creation or that we are the creation. So therefore there has to be a creator. However, nothing is scientifically proven that we are a creation.
You don't need faith to believe in a creator. All you need is eyes that can see and a brain that works.
If the predication of our scientific endeavors is based on our five senses, then if none of those work to observe, measure, test, demonstrate or repeat, then neither of what you're mentioning can actually be real. It just doesn't work that way. Even the effects of gravity can be observed, tested, and measured. We travel at a rate of 1,000 miles per hour around the sun, and because of the rotation, we can actually determine the curvature of degree of which things fall, which is 9 seconds a minute, I think. Something like that.
Could I ever convince you that my car had no makeup? I say, hey, do you like my new car? And you say, what a beautiful car. What make is it? I say, oh, it didn't have a make. It fell together at the back of our yard. Took millions of years. You say, come on. What make is it?
See, this is an argument from ignorance. If you were to say it was a tree, or if you were to say this river developed itself over hundreds of years, that's a lot different than if a car did it, because we know a car is manufactured. It is not a naturally occurring item. You are arguing the incorrect items. I'm sorry, guys. This is really tough to hear sometimes because it's so stupid.
And look at the human body. You have a windshield to see where you're going. This windshield, these eyes that we take for granted, have 137 million light-sensitive cells. The focusing muscles in the eye move an estimated 100,000 times a day. Man has never invented a camera lens anywhere near as intricate as the human eye.
Because a camera has not had millions of years to evolve or thousands of years to evolve. The eye itself is a very intricate system, and it took thousands of years and generations and micromutations to make it happen to the point where we can actually see and observe things, but it's still not perfected. That's why most of us have to have focal lenses and corrective vision and everything.
Well, think of the design of the human ear. Look where they're positioned on my head to capture sound. They've even got little grooves to feed the sound down into the brain, that incredibly complex computer system.
That is not actually what the ears do, and we've actually evolved, and we have evidence of this evolution of ears from a mammalian auditory ossicles, which was an evolutionary event in which bones in the jaw of reptiles were co-opted to form part of the hearing apparatus in mammals. The event is well documented and important as a demonstration of transitional forms and expectation, the repurposing of existing structures during evolution. In reptiles, the eardrum is connected to the inner ear via a single bone, the columella, while the upper and lower jaws contain several bones not found in mammals. Over the course of the evolution of mammals, one bone from the lower and one from the upper jaw, the articular and quadrate bones, lost their purpose in the jaw joint and were put to new use in the middle ear, connecting to the existing stapes bone, forming a chain of three bones. The ossicles, which transmit sounds more efficiently and allow more accurate hearing in mammals, these three bones are known as the malleus, incus, and stapes. I said stapes earlier, I apologize. Hammer, anvil, and stirrup, respectively. Mammals and birds also differ from other vertebrates by having evolved cochlea. The evidence that the malleus and incus are homologous to the reptilian articular and quadrant was originally embryological. And since this discovery, an abundance of transitional fossils has both supported the conclusion and given a detailed history of the transition. The evolution of the stapes from the hyomandibla was an earlier and distinct event. So just to kind of show you that the ears are not designed to do what you said they were. It helps by all means, but it is not how it is actually meant to work or why we evolved to these.
Or consider the marvel of the human hand, the respiratory system, the nervous system, or the complex reproductive system and the entire animal kingdom, both male and female. So just as I don't need faith to believe in a builder because I have the building as evidence, I don't need faith to believe in a creator because I have this incredible, marvelous creation of evidence.
Once again, that's interpretive and biased. You are saying that it's evidence of this, and actually it is not evidence of a builder or creator, because if you come to a garden and it looks great, it looks magnificent, and it looks like it's been tended to, because it's naturally occurring, it may not actually have been attended. Therefore, there's no proof that or evidence that you have somebody that is tending to the garden. I hope what you guys are seeing is that there are these illogical fallacies and ideologues and things that are just being said, like arguments from ignorance. He's just ignorant of the fact that this claim of creation is only a claim based on if God is real. So you still have to prove God is real to make a creation claim, which the evidence does not point to a God that is real. It just merely points to a long-term form of evolution. The nervous system was a really longly developed evolutionary system. That's why people walk when doctors say it's likely you will not walk. Because there's a lot of different things that our body can do. I just did a recent podcast on how God's new miracle helps you pass gas from gastroparesis. And it's not the way it works. It's not the way God works. He said there was a tingling in his right shoulder that went down to his stomach, and then boom, he released it all and was able to feel better and great and never had an issue again. But what that means is it took the body that long to develop a connection from the nerve endings in his nervous system and his spinal cord in order to control and react to that muscle group. That's what happened. That's what took so long. That's it. It wasn't God. It wasn't anything else. This argument that we are so intricate and so technically difficult and irreducibly complex is proof that there's a God is not actually proof that there's a God. Actually, it fits more with evolutionary theory.
All I need is eyes that can see and a brain that works.
Then you might want to get those checked because yours aren't working all that well.
The invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made. Now, if I want the builder to do something for me, then I need to have faith in him.
You don't need to have faith in your builder. You just need to get his business card. Where's God's business card? Can I talk with God right now, please? I have some grievances about this creation thing.
And the same applies with God. If I want God to do something for me, then I need to have faith in him. He that comes to God must first believe that he is or that he exists.
Say what now?
And he's the rewarder of those that diligently seek him, for without faith it is impossible to please him.
So a guy I never met is demanding I have faith in his abilities of work I've never seen or been proven of, and I'm just supposed to have faith in him. That's like hiring a homeless person to work in your home and have faith he's not going to steal anything or fuck anything up.
So there is a difference between an intellectual belief in God's existence and putting your trust in him, your faith in him. So how does an atheist deal with such rational logic?
We don't believe in imaginary things. Pretty easy.
Why, what he does is he becomes unreasonable and puts himself above it and says, that's just painting painters beneath me. He puts himself on an intellectual pedestal.
No, he puts himself on the side of being right and erring on the side of being wrong. I mean, seriously. Dang, how dare somebody put themselves on an intellectual pedestal rather than just being on the side that's right until something is yet proven?
Which brings me to my second evidence of God's existence, something that God has put within each of us, the conscience.
Before he gets a little off topic here and gives you a definition that might be wrong, I don't know yet, I haven't listened to this. Conscience is an inner feeling or voice viewed as acting as a guide to the rightness or wrongness of one's behavior. It also has to do with the rightness or wrongness of life in general and discerning what is right or what is wrong. And it's through a systematic or mechanical properties within the brain and body that allow interpretation of different things. Now, that's why so many things are left to perspective. As much of consciousness is awareness, we have the ability to be wrong and perceive things incorrectly.
Now, the conscience is the impartial judge on the courtroom of the mind. It speaks to us irrespective of our will, whether we believe in God or not. It can be so powerful, it's driven men to suicide. Now, human beings are unique in that we're moral creatures. We're made in the image of God, and that's what separates us from the animals. We have a distinctive knowledge of right and wrong, so we set up court systems to punish wrongdoing. Animals don't do that.
Animals may not do that, but the gorilla, the monkey, and the chimp all will rip your arms off if you cross them or bring them shame or dishonor them in any way. The hierarchy system in the animal kingdom is a lot more primal than ours. But because we were primal at one time, and we actually are still animals, we are Homo sapien, which means we have a common ancestor as the apes do. Not chimps or monkeys, we don't have tails, neither do they. Just to keep, you know, clear that one up a little bit. But we have evolved to a point to think and have awareness and to actually comprehend and think about things that come across our paths and everything. We have the ability to develop a justice system. We didn't always have it, though. And that's why you had the Dark Ages and all these other things where people were dying because people didn't believe what they believed. And you had the witch trials and everything when people thought, oh, magic's real. So come on, Ray, use a little bit of intelligence here. You're really killing me with this.
The word conscience actually comes from two words, con with science, knowledge. Conscience means with knowledge. And each of us have this inbuilt knowledge that it's wrong to lie, to steal, to commit adultery, to murder. But the problem is our conscience is seared. That means it's lost its life on the outside. And what we need to make that conscience come back to life is the Ten Commandments.
Just, wow, we need the Ten Commandments? You mean six of them that are just about if you disobey God? That's not Ten Commandments, come on, dude, and that's not even morality. All right, so a quick little lesson in how the brain works and how we develop morality and how we discern right and wrong. It's a chemical process in the brain that happens from when we are children and whether or not certain things are enforced, whether or not we learn to test boundaries. If we are unaware as children or just given toys as a form of reinforcement, what happens is we tend to become very complacent. And we don't try things. We don't take risks. We don't do a lot of things. If we don't rough and tumble at the age of four, it becomes very difficult to develop a boundary or sense of boundaries of what our limits are. And if we don't socialize or interact with people at a young age, we tend to not know how much we can win or how much we can lose. By the time we become adults, we are then the spoiled, rotten, entitled child that is formerly known as a child adult or a man child, woman child. And you see tantrums and you see fits and you see, watch Cops. That's where they all end up because they don't have those proper raising development systems. And if you don't get the chemical reaction to certain things, in other words, you don't get the butterflies in the stomach when you're about to do something wrong, it's because you never developed that as a kid. That's why it's okay to hit your kid on the hand if they're about to pull a boiling pot of water off the stove. Yeah, smack them on the hand. Let them know that basically, I mean, it's a lot better than getting burned with scalding water and having permanent third-degree burns for the rest of your life. But let them know that the chemical process will happen if they go to touch this. In other words, you're developing their alert system, their alarm system, their nervous system in their body to get them to go, oh, I shouldn't do that. Oh, I'm going to get hurt. oh, I need to, you know, fear this type of thing. Now, it needs to be used in the right way. When used in the wrong way, you can actually develop the wrong sense of, you know, right and wrong and all that kind of thing. So morality doesn't come from God. If it did, then it would be very solid. It'd be very easy. No one would debate it, question it, or even ponder it. It would just be naturally instilled in us. We don't need 10 commandments that mainly talk about disobeying God and what it would mean if you did. That's not morality. That's just following some stupid hokum.
Now, the 10 commandments are like a mirror. When you and I got up this morning, one of the first things we did was go to the mirror. Why did we do that? We wanted to see what damage had been done during the night. And all the mirror does is reflect what we are in truth, so we can get things fixed up before we go public. So what we're going to do is look at the mirror of the Ten Commandments just for a few moments. Have you ever told a lie? Have you broken that commandment? I'm not talking about discretion. You know, my grandma's 115 and he said, Grandma, you look just gorgeous. I'm not talking about discretion. I'm talking about a bold-faced lie. Have you ever lied? So if you've lied, what does it make you? It makes you a liar. Another commandment, you shall not steal. Have you ever stolen something? Irrespective of its value. If you've taken something that belongs to someone else, then you're a thief. Here's another commandment, you shall not take God's name in vain. Have you ever used God's name in vain? Have you ever used God's name as a cuss word to express disgust? Think about it. God gave you life, and you've taken his holy name and used it in what's called blasphemy, which is very serious in God's sight. Final one, and this is a heavy one. This one nailed me to the wall. You've heard it said by them of old, you shall not commit adultery, seventh commandment. But he said, I say to you, whoever looks upon a woman to lust after her has committed adultery already with her in his heart. Most Americans actually believe in the existence of God. We say, yeah, there is a literal place called hell that's reserved for Hitler and mass murderers. And it's true. God is going to punish murderers. He's good. He's just. He's going to make sure murderers get what's coming to them.
Actually, no. God's not going to make sure that murderers get what's coming to them because there is no God. But let's say there is, okay? And let's say the Bible is being honest and truthful. Well, then John 3:16, for whoever believes in him shall not perish but have everlasting life. That is the only requirement, the one requirement that it takes to be eternal with God. That is it. So a confessing, dying, thieving, murderous person who even murders 40,000 people can say, God, forgive me, I believe in you, and right before, up to the moment of his death, be accepted into heaven. Is that a just God? Is that really what it's about? And if that's all it takes, not to mention the people who don't know about heaven or hell, if you tell them, now they are now burdened with whether or not they get to choose to go to heaven or hell or not, wouldn't it be better to just not say anything at that point? I know that's one of those things on the bingo charts, but I mean, come on. God is going to give the murderers what's coming to them. He's a murderer himself. And in the Bible has done many different things to murder people. The flood, for instance. Hey, here's my creation. I fucked it up. I'm going to drown it all. Why not just recreate it? Go over there and slay and slander and kill all those people over there. Yeah, I don't know, man. I think you're a bit full of some poop.
But realize this, God is so good, he's also going to punish rapists, adulterers, pedophiles, fornicators, blasphemers, hypocrites, and even thieves and liars.
How about the part of the Bible where it says that if a man rapes a woman and defiles her, that he can pay 50 shekels to the father and then has to marry her to keep her from being a defiled, damaged piece of goods? What about that part of the Bible? That is in there. It is allowed, what it says. How about the part of owning slaves where that says it's okay to own people? It's okay to beat them as long as you don't kill them within 2 days. And none of that has ever been fixed since the Bible was written. None of it has ever been amended or anything. It's the same word today, tomorrow, and yesterday, apparently. Or how about the part where it says to kill all the women, kill all the men, kill all the babies, children, and livestock, except for the women you wish to keep for yourselves? Just saying. You know, that there's a lot of stuff that you say is not how God operates or in the Bible, yet there it is.
This is the radical nature of conversion. Here's the essence of what I'm saying. If you realize you need God's forgiveness and you seek His forgiveness through the gospel, God Himself will reveal Himself to you. That is the ultimate proof.
So the ultimate proof is if you already believe in Him before Him showing Himself to you, then in accepting that you need His forgiveness, once again, before even meeting the guy, and by His standards that you have supposed to have been living by already, that is the ultimate proof of God. That's proof of nothing. And all these people are believing you, and you just think it's okay to keep saying, this is how you prove God. It's really not. All you've proven is paranoia. If you are paranoid that what you did was wrong or morally incorrect, or that there is going to be some punishment if you don't listen to what this person is saying, paranoia, then God will reveal Himself to you, but not in the way that you think He will, in whatever way He chooses. That is still paranoia.
Again, please be patient with me. This sounds kind of preachy, but if you don't understand the gospel, you won't respond to the gospel, which is the greatest proof you could ever have. You and I are part of the ultimate statistic, 10 out of 10 die. Now, there's something in you and I that says, oh, I don't want to die. That's your God-given will to live. Listen to it. Because God, the judge of the universe, has proclaimed the death sentence upon the entire human race. The soul that sins it shall die. But the same God is rich in mercy. And the Bible says He sent His Son to suffer and die on the cross to take the punishment for our sins. We broke God's law, and Jesus paid our fine. Then He rose from the dead, defeated death, and now God offers everlasting life to all those who repent and trust the Savior. You know the Bible verse. Who in America doesn't know this? For God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whoever believes on Him should not perish, but have everlasting life.
Really, you should be able to make those connections yourself as to why murderers then would not get to go to hell if they accept Christ at the end. I mean, I'm just saying. And then not only that, God still couldn't reveal Himself right then and there. He had to bring it in the form of a person that is subjective, someone who never claimed to be God or Son of God, and who actually prayed to God Himself. So once again, Jesus and God and all this is made up. Also for the fact that we don't have any paintings of Jesus, or we don't have any actual real evidence of them, kind of shows that there was never a painter. Now, Ray goes on to say a couple of things that are just kind of off the wall and out there, and says like conscience is knowledge and this is that, and it just makes no sense of how he's translating it all, and it's just a workaround to make it all work for him. Next is Kirk Cameron, and let's see what he has to say.
Well, let me start by saying that I really feel a bit of kinship with Brian and Kelly. I understand where they're coming from. I used to think just like they think. I used to be an atheist. I believed what they believed, and I blindly believed what my science teachers told me in school, because I figured, well, they were a lot smarter than I was, so what they say must be true. There wouldn't be a hidden agenda there. I had faith in what they said.
Now, I can agree to this to some level or extent, and the reason why is because anytime we don't test something for ourselves or learn how to discern something for ourselves to a objectionable truth, in other words, it's not subjective to our personal opinion, we have to take faith in what other people say, or if they are smarter than us. And I do that through my schooling and through my papers and everything, too. I don't know something well enough until later. And so I always feel like I'm guessing initially in the beginning, or, you know, I'm going off this research and I go, well, this person is saying it, this person is saying it. So I reference maybe three or four people that kind of say the same thing or in the same area, and we're all coming to the same conclusion. The hard part is I don't know how correct I'm being, because I've been wrong, and I find out later, oh, this is actually not the correct thing, even though a lot of people say it. But that's because I'm figuring it out for myself. And that is something that we have to do, and it doesn't get really taught in schools anymore. And that's called critical thinking. That's what it was labeled under. And yeah, so Kirk is kind of right. You have to take faith on it. However, there's a huge difference when you were never a Christian and then becoming one, and then when you were a Christian or grew up in it most of your life and then found out why you're not going to be one. or, you know, it just kind of happens. It phases out. It's not like one day you decide not to be it, or I'm just going to throw this off and not care. It is a development. It is not overnight.
But the problem was, I never really took the time to look into the evidence myself, do the research, and actually see if the claims that they were making were true. You see, when I was on Growing Pains, I was 17 years old. I was at the height of the success of the show, and I had the world by the tail. I was making lots of cash. I was really famous. I was doing everything I wanted. There was nothing that was holding me back. I had everything. I did not need God. There was no motivation for me to want to believe in any kind of a fairy tale. But I was highly interested in the subject because I knew that 10 out of 10 people die, and I knew that one day I would die and I would find out the truth about whether or not there was a God. And I wondered about this. And so I decided, if there was a God who had given me my life and everything I held dear to me, and all I had given him was my rebellion, my attitude, my sarcasm, and my unbelief, all of my money and fame and popularity that impressed others wouldn't help me one bit on that day.
Notice he still said, if there was a God. Well, we don't know. So basing your whole life and whether or not it was good or wrong or bad was, you know, on an if. Here's the thing. We all have the right and ability to defend our way of living and making our way through life. There is no reason that we have to be told that we have to live this one way. There are so many people that have lived so many different ways and are very successful or whatever, but it all comes at a cost. There's a balance. There's work, life, play, and there's a balance of whether or not it works out or doesn't work out. And not everybody is going to be capable of what someone else is, or the fame or the riches and everything. And they are living a very different life than we are. I think it's a luxury to go through life not having everybody at a grocery store know exactly who you are. I think it's a luxury not having to wear a hat and, you know, hide yourself and hope a mob doesn't find you. Or to have paparazzi always taking your picture whether you know it or not. I mean, there's a lot of issues where it could be very paranoid and, you know, you could develop a lot of mental issues just being in that kind of lifestyle. Now, I don't think you're wrong necessarily in kind of getting out of the Hollywood light there, but I wouldn't base it on whether it was right or wrong. You still could live your life a good way. It's not wrong that you happen to have that lifestyle. I think that's a very terrible thing to say and very judgmental, and I think it's poorly thought out, to be honest. But you said if there's a God and if when you die is when you find out. Well, if life is based on awareness and consciousness now, what makes you so sure that when you're dead, there is life and consciousness or awareness? These are things that we need to either prove or eliminate as a possibility until something is evident that leads to that conclusion. And so far, we don't have anything.
And I decided I wanted to get to the bottom of the issue. And so I started researching it. I started checking out the evidence. I put my own career at risk. My only motivation was to want to know the truth. So one day I was in my sports car, pulled off to the side of the road, and I said, God, if you're there, I want to know. I've never prayed before. If you're real, please show me. I don't want to believe in a fairy tale. I don't want to commit intellectual suicide, but I want to know the truth. And I opened my eyes. It wasn't like I saw a vision. I didn't hear voices. Jesus wasn't on the windshield. The Holy Spirit didn't rush in through the air conditioning vents and blow my hair back. But I had this sense that something had clearly changed in my attitude, and I had humbled myself before the possibility of an all-powerful God who perhaps created me.
Do you know what you did there? You gave in and believed. That's exactly what that is. I can have that same feeling, same emotion at a concert. It's nothing special. It's nothing. It's not anything. And unfortunately, a lot of people's behaviors don't change. It's you wanted it, you desired to change. You wanted a different lifestyle. This was just the one thing to help you achieve it. Maslow's hierarchy has many different things that accommodate and describe our need and desire in life. The five human needs. These hierarchy of needs can be found in a book and that was written in 1954 by Maslow, Motivation and Personality. So the five fundamental hierarchy of needs is physiological, safety, love and belonging, esteem, and self-actualization. If we have these things addressed then or lacking, we will find whatever it is in order to feed these things. In other words, in order to replace them or put something there that makes us whole in that category or area. Religion tends to do that. We have a need for safety, so we call on a God, or God can fill that need. And if we are told that God can fill that need and we are lacking it, then we are likely to be more drawn to it. Love and belonging. Within that need is religion. And religion, it can be very open and sound like they're very accepting and loving, even though I believe they're very judgmental based on a lot of evidence. And that if you're feeling a lack of love and belonging, a religion can fill that. And the same goes for esteem. If you're feeling like you have a low self-esteem, you might find people that claim to be non-judgmental for the sake of God, because everyone is his creation, and rather than doing it out of their own will, they will do it because God has said so, because it's loving. Those are three of the big ones that tend to attract people to religion. And you know, Kirk, if you were feeling that as a child, a lack of love or safety or maybe esteem, maybe self-actualization, maybe you didn't actually know who you were as a person. Maybe. I don't know. I'm just saying. Then religion would be very appealing to you. But or so would God. I wouldn't say that in your case, though, that that's what you experienced and that's what it was. I think you were in a moment that this is how you work through it. And you're just attributing it to God rather than, you know, seeking help or, you know, any other means for it. It's okay. It's not wrong. I'm just saying. I don't think it was God.
And there was a change in my heart. I began reading the Bible, which was once dead letter to me, made no sense to me, came to life and spoke to me in an extremely powerful way.
Because of that desire to want to believe in these things, and then it kind of sounds like you all of a sudden go, oh, now this is making sense and this is making sense. It's no different than finding a really good self-help book, which I did when I first started in psychology. I read a book, The Human Magnet Syndrome by Ross Rosenberg, and I finally went, you know what? There's somebody else out there that understands and everything I've gone through, and no longer do all the things I say about what happened to me sound crazy. Because I'm not the only person who experienced it. Now, that happened. That changed my life. But I'm not attributing it to God or anything, because God didn't do that. I did that. I found something. You know, someone else did. It fulfilled the same needs. It's just sometimes we have to find the right path or the right information to motivate us to learn more and to understand more. And then things just start to click. And when one thing clicks, the next thing clicks, etc.
I began going to church, learning more about this God of the Bible. God began transforming me on the inside. I began to love the God I once mocked in sarcasm. And I began to really despise and hate the sin that I once loved and enjoyed so much.
Likely because it wasn't acceptable among the new community of people that you are now socializing with, you know, i.e. the church. But then I wonder, how bad was your lifestyle before that? Or are you just saying it was bad?
This wasn't a change I was trying to produce in myself. And as I began to study more deeply the issues of science and history and the Bible and look into the questions and objections that you're hearing today, I found that all the evidence points to support my decision to trust and believe in the living God.
So what you heard there was a testimony, and people in religion tend to believe that these testimonies mean so much of transformation and that this is evidence of God, because someone can tell a story of how their life had a moment of change. And I can show you so many points where people have had moments of change in their life where God was never present or the topic or subject of that said change. And these things happen more when we have a realization or a epiphany in those moments that then go, hey, now I can make the changes. Now I can do things a different way. I figured it out. And no longer do I have to continue being wrong or doing this dumb thing that's getting me in trouble or whatever it is. I now found a way I can do it in a way. I now found a way that I can do things better and more positive in a better direction. That's why you put away childish things. And one thing in the Bible that actually kind of makes a little bit of sense, but what doesn't make sense is it later then says you have to have a childlike faith. That to me is just ridiculous.
This is simply a wake-up call. Don't sit on the sidelines. You have stakes in this debate. What you believe about God will determine where you spend eternity. So think and listen carefully. Thank you very much.
In another segment that I cut out just because it was talking about one of the other atheist panels, and it isn't anything bad. You can look it up on YouTube and or in the links in the description and just kind of see for yourself what it was. But anyways, he describes how there was a conversation that went on between him and Brian, and basically it was, I will pray for you, that Kirk said, and he replied with, I will think for you as well. And Kirk kind of made I don't want to say a jab. It wasn't really a jab. He was just kind of acknowledging it and said, right on, man. Like, you know, and then he encourages everybody to think today about everything, about what's going to happen. And there's a little bit of controversy I see with this. And the reason why is because it isn't really a, I guess, proper notion to say. And I think one jab for a jab is not really, and again, I don't mean jab, I don't know what other word to use, but for a lack of better word, jab, isn't really the best thing to do in these scenarios, especially when someone says, I'll pray for you. Fine, go ahead, pray for me. But it is no much different than thinking, because you're not actually doing an action, because your God is not proven. Now, there's another clip that I'm going to play from the curator of the debate, which I think is kind of interesting, and we'll go on to that here in a second.
A number of claims based on creation, conscience, and personal conversion, and you relied on the Bible to some extent for some of those. You were using the Ten Commandments. But Kelly makes the point, will you take us to the universe factory? I.e., who created God? If God created all of this, and you said a picture doesn't emerge without there being a painter, well, then who created God?
This argument gets a lot of flack, and for the main reason that where's the God universe? Where's the factory that built God or made God? And that is quite the argument. It's a roundabout argument that never seems to come to a fruition. And the reason why is because God is supposed to be the origin story, like the God particle, the original thing, the nothing, something from nothing. However, I think it becomes a very illogical argument for the fact that we can't test for it, we can't prove it, we can't even fathom how it could have worked, and there is none of that answers within a Bible or a text or anywhere. And that would be kind of important to put in there, not just for how we were created, but also too how our God operates and all that. And the one thing that we don't have in the Bible that would make the argument to any Christian is how God operates. We have a book of people that wrote it who think they know how God operates. That's why it's the inspirational word of God, not the written word from God, or it's the written word of God. In other words, it's the interpretation of what they think God would have said. In the next clip, Ray Comfort's asked a question, that same question that we were discussing here. And he goes on to talk about the Jews and Gentiles and starts making up rules of who does not get into heaven, when we don't even know if heaven is real or how you get into heaven, or if there's no confirmed method for getting into heaven. The only thing we do know is what a Bible says. That doesn't mean it's true. So we can go on, we believe the Bible says this, or we know the Bible says this. But that doesn't mean that what it says is therefore true. And that is one of the common arguments that has to really get out there. And what happens is you don't get a lot of followers on that. And so there's a thing called branding in religion. And religion brands change. It went from a very dark, scary God to a now pleasant one that rules out all the previous things. Yet it says in the Bible, no gods before me. And then Jesus comes and says, no one gets to the Father but through me. And it just, it's a conflict all around. So where's the battle? It's within the Bible. It's not between religions, not spiritual. It's not reality. It's the battle between reality and sanity, or sanity and delusion. So what should be discussed is that everything is a belief. Here's what we believe based on what the Bible says. We don't know what's true. And that disclaimer should almost always be there. Because you're not talking about God as if you know something. You're talking about faith and belief, which are both things that you don't have to have any actual evidence to be convinced of. Both of those things can happen regardless of or if it's real or not or true or not. You can believe in leprechauns and unicorns because the evidence doesn't matter whether or not you believe it or have faith in it. But you can't have faith or belief in something if you know it to be true. Do you have to have faith and believe that a car exists? No, because you know it does. Now, your faith and belief, kind of like Ray said, is in its ability, but it still exists, and you know that. So having faith and belief in something that we do not know exists is absolutely ridiculous. And it's just a paranoid way of saying believe in this even if it's not true. It could be, but that isn't a good enough reason to believe in it. We could believe in World War III is going to happen tomorrow, but that is no reason to go out and start buying generators and guns and weapons for the if possibility that it's going to happen tomorrow. Therefore, there's no reason to prepare for a place, heaven or hell, that doesn't morally make any kind of sense if it exists or doesn't, for the possibility of if.
Okay, I'd like to address that. It's a great question. But before I do, I'd like to respond to a couple of very important things Kelly said. Firstly, about Jews not going to heaven. The first 3,000 Christians were Jews, if you read the book of Acts. I'm Jewish, so the gospel is open to Jew and Gentile. And the second one is the question you're asking, who made God? It's got a very simple answer. God is eternal. He is outside of the realm of time. Time is a dimension God created and subjected man to. You and I are bound by time. And because we're in time, logic demands everything must have a beginning and an end. That's how we think, because we're in time.
Well, if you actually knew anything about time, time is relative to our location, our position in the universe. If you distance away or move away from the Earth and in time and space, which are supposedly the same thing, it starts to change. Therefore, you don't have a beginning and end. You have what is constant. You have a constant or a factor of time that changes constantly. It's a measurement of distance relative to location. Again, time is a construct that is just not actually a thing. It's just a form of measurement that we can use based on the rotation and movement and speed of our position in the universe. So time is not actually a thing. We are not bound by time. There's no such thing as eternity as far as an existence of a being. We are constructed as people to have a lifespan or to have a certain condition of life that eventually at some point we do die. But, okay, so you say that God exists inside and outside of time in a supernatural like universe or whatever. If that's true, where's the proof? Where's the evidence for that? And you can't just say, oh, because I can observe something here in this earth, in the natural world, which is the natural universe, that you can prove the supernatural. Or the common argument that I always get is you can't test the supernatural with any of the natural means. Well, then that means it's imaginary. It doesn't exist. You haven't seen it. If you see it or observe it with your eyes, that is a natural method of observation, which therefore, if anything supernatural interferes with our natural world and you can observe it, you can comprehend it in some way by any of the five senses or brain, you know, interpretation, it has to be demonstrable and repeatable, then it can be true. But if you can't do any of those, it is not.
But God dwells in eternity outside of that dimension where there's neither beginning nor end.
And we have no proof of outer dimensions, so that's kind of a faulty or moot argument.
The problem, though, Ray, with that argument is that you were proposing the notion that there is no picture without a painter. You were the one who was proposing the notion there's no creation without a creator. Yet now you're using time and chronology to somehow get out of the fact that we need to know who created the creator. That's what they're asking.
That's what I'm answering. God dwells in eternity where there is neither beginning nor end. That's why when Moses said to God, what's your name? And he said, I am. God is. There's neither past nor present with God. He is in eternity. And when you and I die, we will move out of time into eternity. And there are things we believe in. A space has no beginning and no end. We accept that by faith. You can go a billion miles that way and a billion miles that way, and there's not a brick wall that says the end.
Then how do you explain those that saw the face of God, as mentioned in the Bible, and those who couldn't, because if they did, would burn or die? And it just seems kind of like a made-up thing. Well, if you see it, you will die. And that's made up. You know, I mean, if I brought to you a plate and I said there is a juicy, delicious turkey with gravy, potatoes, and, you know, asparagus, would you then tell me there is nothing on your plate? If I say there is, and I believe there is, and I say, well, it's there, you're just not believing hard enough. You just don't understand. You first have to believe it's there in order for it to show up and be real. You can see the fallacies in these arguments. They're not very pretentious.
So just as we receive that by faith, we just have to trust there's no beginning and end to space. So God is eternal. He dwells outside of dimension. We're in. He dwells in eternity.
Kelly made the point about the multiplicity of religions. If you were born in Pakistan, you might well call your faith Islam. If you were born in India, you might well call your faith Hinduism. The argument goes that your God is in fact a projection of your personal culture. And that's why there are all these different religions around the world. And what that means is that the existence of God is a projection by you from your Western culture of Christianity. But equally, I could take you to Lahore in Pakistan, where people there project Islam as being their God. That doesn't prove the existence of God. What that proves, as one author, Michael Onfray, has said in his book, The Atheist Manifesto, he says, atheism is not therapy, but restored mental health, because claiming the existence of God is a mental delusion.
And that's where I'm going to end it then. You couldn't have said it any better, and that is the best way to end this episode. You know, God is a delusion based on a projection of people and culture, and that can be proven repeatedly. As, you know, you go anywhere, you can find no proof of any God of all 3,999, not even this one. If you think I'm wrong or if I missed something, please write me at Facebook at the Adam Paradox Podcast or on Twitter at One Adam Paradox. That is the number one. And check me out on anchor.fm, The Adam Paradox. Again, I'm on Apple, iTunes, Google Podcasts. I'm on Spotify. I'm on all sorts of things. Find my podcast. Check it out. Listen. I'm always looking for guests. So if you have an interesting story or something you would like to talk about, hit me up and I will get you on the show. We'll do a recording. Scheduling is going to change soon. So be attentive to maybe some odd hours. In the meantime, check out my pages, check out my show, check out my other episodes.